Thank you for joining us on the Entrepreneur Dad podcast, where we talk to entrepreneurs, high-level executives, and overall just people that are working their butt off to make a great living for themselves. In this, what we do is we examine their journey, their ups, their downs, their transitions, and also how to remain great spouses and loving parents while managing a full daily schedule. Thank you so much, and I hope you get tons of value out of your time with us. Hey guys, thank you so much for joining us today. We are here with Lewin Nguyen, and he is an amazing entrepreneur here in Birmingham. He's got an incredible story that you're going to hear today, and so I am so glad that you're with us. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about business, we're going to talk about life, we're going to talk about his story, but we're also going to talk about him being a dad here really, really soon, and so we're excited about that. It's going to be a lot of fun, so I'm so thankful that you joined us today. So Lewin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Man, thank you so much.
I'm so glad to have you. So we met, honestly, we met simply because of the multiplicity of people saying, hey, you need to meet the guy that owns Wheelhouse. Hey, you need to meet him. Hey, I'm a member at Wheelhouse. What do I need to get the food down there? And then I think I just picked up the phone or email and just said, hey, bro, there's like been five people say that we need to meet. And I remember you had said there's a couple people that said we needed to get hooked up. And so finally we just sat down one day for like 2 or 3 hours and talked.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people I've told about you, your story, what you're doing. I know I've got some friends of mine that go to your gym in on Homewood. And so you're right in the center of downtown. You got an amazing thing going. So give me a little bit of background about you, where you're from, all those different types of things.
So I grew up in Mobile, so just a few hours south of here.
Okay.
Spent my time all the way from basically elementary through high school and then went to college in South Alabama. And then after that, ventured my way north just a little bit to Birmingham, and I've been in Birmingham ever since. So now I call Birmingham home. Been here for about 18 years now. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah,
so now, look, you don't look, okay, it's just being super transparent.
Look, Southern.
You don't look like you're from, you don't look like a Mobilian. So you're from Vietnam.
Yeah.
Nguyen is like the Vietnamese name,
yeah.
The Smith of
yeah.
Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so you were born and raised in Vietnam. So how old were you when you moved here?
So yeah, I'm first generation. Moved here when I was 4. So
how much do you remember from Vietnam, from living in Vietnam?
Little snippets here and there.
Okay, so how did, so you, we kind of went over the story a little bit before, but I want you to tell everybody, when you guys moved here, it's kind of a nutty story.
It's a nutty story.
And so just kind of unpack that from like what your parents did in Vietnam to you guys trying to leave and then getting here. Just kind of give them an idea of that.
So, you know, growing up, you always get that question, who's your hero?
No doubt, yeah.
My dad is my hero.
That's awesome.
I truly mean that just for so many reasons. He still is. He's still living in Mobile. So
gotcha.
I know that question gets up a lot. But, you know, when the Vietnam War started, we were from the South,
right?
South Vietnam. I was born in Saigon, which is now turned into a different name. And then we were living just about 15, 20 minutes outside of Saigon. And that's where my family had a small business, and dad was a truck driver, and mom was a seamstress, and
both business owners.
Both business
okay,
owners.
Okay, that's
right.
Huge.
Yeah, for sure. And you just work to make ends meet, and then when the war began, my dad enlisted and went to the South Republic Vietnamese Army.
Why did he enlist? Just felt like it was his duty? What?
You know, it was a big civil war. It was North versus South, and wanted to not go towards the communist ways of the North. And he ended up serving time and moved his ways up the rankings to become captain in the Vietnamese Army, and would often work alongside U.S. soldiers and platoons the time. Saigon fell in 1975.
Okay.
So after 75, a lot of soldiers got to go home.
Right.
Guys like my dad, they took him in and they put him in prison.
Wow. The North
did. Yeah. Okay. He tells a story. First off, growing up, I never could ever pull the story of our escape out from dad.
Wow.
And it was just something that he never really wanted to talk about. You know, you hear about this PTSD of post-war traumatic and that was a real thing. He never really wanted to talk about it. Times were hard.
Yeah.
He'd seen a lot of his buddies die in his arms, and it was a tough thing.
Right.
And then I think coming to the States was very tough for him, too. But I remember the very first time I heard the story of our escape. I am 17 years old.
That's crazy.
I'm a senior in high school. And in Mobile, Alabama, on a Friday, all you are looking forward to is the football game at night.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah.
And I remember, okay, well, it's Friday night. We're going to go watch Davidson High School play whoever.
Yeah.
And that was just what we did. And this particular night over dinner, I don't know how. I would always just, hey, Dad, tell me about the war every now and again.
Yeah.
And he was like, you don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
And I would just leave it alone. But this one night, he just started talking and talking and talking and talking. And I remember in the middle of the conversation, my buddies.
You got your boy sitting around.
They called.
And okay,
They said, hey, you ready for us to come pick you up? We're going to the game. Or maybe you come pick us up, whatever it was. And I remember it was one of those moments where I said, hey, fellas, I'm not going to make it tonight. Like, I'll talk to you later. And it was, what are you doing not going to the game?
Right. And so as a 17-year-old kid, Friday night's a big deal. There's only 10 or 12 of them. And so you're going to get hang with your buddies, see the girls, all that stuff.
That's right.
Your dad is telling you a story, and you're so entrenched in the story that you're like, hey, guys, I'm not coming. I'm listening to my dad tell the story.
I'll explain later. And I just don't even – I just hang up, and I go back to dad. And it was one of those moments where I didn't want to push him so much and try to pull so much from him that he would just shut down and say, forget it. But I just let him talk, and he told me about this story.
Yeah.
I held on to that story, and it was probably about a good year later that I heard version number two. Mm. And the second time I heard it, I'm probably 18 now, and my mom was in the kitchen. And then now I got to hear mom. I remember I was sitting at the kitchen table, dad and I, and my mom's just a few feet away from us. I think she was probably cooking, preparing dinner. And she would interject and say, no, you remember this happened. While you were going through this, I was going through this.
Wow.
So I got to hear them, and I'm just on a, my head was on a swivel, and I was just thinking, man, I wish I had a tape recorder.
Right.
So just growing up, any moment I could get to hear the story, would just really, and remind me to tell you about our New York trip that I took dad on.
Okay.
Just last fall. So kind of wrap it all up. But basically, you know, when Saigon fell, when dad heard about it, he was miles away. He was in the middle of the fight.
Right.
And he'd got news that this was happening. And he knew that he would go home. And when he went home, he tells about how he was peeking at his home, at his land, his property, through the bushes. And he could see the tanks rolling in.
Wow.
And the troops just marching and collecting up all the weapons, all the guns, all the people. They grabbed him up. They put him in their prison camp.
Right.
Because he was a captain, it was one of those things he said, you know, it's just like the movies. They put me in a room, put me in a chair, shine a spotlight on me, tied my hands behind my back, and just would do whatever they need to get questions from me.
Trying to extract information.
Yeah.
So how old are you at this time?
That.
When this is going down, how old are you?
I'm not born yet.
Not born yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is 75.
Okay.
And I'm born in 78.
Okay.
So they keep dad for two and a half years. In this prison.
Wow.
Right? He's dealing with all this stuff. He tells me about how he was fed 3 bowls of rice each day, very malnutrition, and just hard working out later in the day, and then at night just extracting information.
Right.
After about 2+ years, they said, you can go home. We're done with you. So he comes home. Mom's there.
Right.
Mom gets pregnant.
Amen.
Lewin. Amen. Little Lewin, right? Mom's pregnant with little Lewin. They go back and say, hey, we got more questions from you. Brings him back in.
Holy crap.
So mom goes through her pregnancy, not knowing, well, where are you taking my husband? Oh, we got more questions from him. You just took him for 2+ years. We got more questions. Well, when is he coming back? We don't have to tell you. So he spends another 2.5 years. So I'm born, I'm 1, I'm 2, my mom's raising me as a single mom,
right.
Mentally, right?
But no she still clue about has your hope. Dad. She's telling you stories about your dad, but you really don't.
That's right. And she still has hope that who knows what's going to happen.
Right?
So one day, and this is the part where dad told me at first, and then a year later mom told me, and she was kind of telling me her side of it. She says, Lou and I go to the market.
Yeah.
And I have you on my hip. And the door gets kicked in. And it is guns blazing, pointing at my face. And I have you. And these soldiers are saying, where's Dad? Where's your husband? And she's like, what are you talking about? You have him.
Yeah. They took him 2 years ago.
They said, your husband's escaped. We're looking for him. If he comes here, you let us know.
Yeah, for sure.
She's just standing there. What are you talking about? Right. He escapes?
Yeah.
So now he's a wanted man. He's a fugitive on the run.
Okay.
Right? No cell phones, no text, no,
yeah,
none of this,
for sure.
Right?
This is in 70. What are
this
years?
Is, by now, this is 80.
So 80, okay.
Yeah.
Almost 40 years.
This is 80, yeah, yeah. So I'm about 2.5, 3 years old now. And
do you remember that happening?
No.
No, yeah.
I don't remember
that. I didn't figure you would.
No, yet. I don't remember that. So she's waiting and just waiting. Now she's even more terrified. He's on the run. What's going to happen to him? If he comes, I want to see him.
But
I know that they're watching, waiting for him. A month goes by. Here's nothing. 2 months goes by. Here's nothing. 8 months go by. 8 months go by. She comes into her house. Again, I'm on her hip. I'm a little bit older now. And she says, I walk into my house, Lewin, and there's a strange man sitting at our table.
The key part of this story, I think,
yeah,
is he escapes.
Yep.
Eight months go by.
Yep.
This is going to come back.
Yeah.
8 months go by. Nothing.
Nothing.
And then there's a strange man. Yep. So the gap is huge.
Yep.
Understanding in this story, because I remember hearing about this going, okay, this is why that was. So there's an 8 month gap. Mom walks in from the market.
Yep.
Lewin's on her hip. You're about three at
yep.
the time. Strange man sitting in the living room.
And she was just, A, you're terrified if a stranger's in your house.
Absolutely.
B, she knows the situation with my dad.
Yep.
This guy, couldn't have made it even worse for her.
No doubt.
He stands up real slow away, walks up to her, reaches in his jacket.
Just like in the movies.
And she says, I'm like, Mom, what are you thinking? And she says, Lewin, all I could do is this.
Mm.
Just turn, because I didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
He reaches in the jacket pocket, pulls out a letter, hands it to her, walks out. Doesn't even say
doesn't
a
say
word.
Nothing.
He was told not to. Here you go. Walks out. She just sat there shaking.
Yeah.
Reading this letter. She opens it up. It's from my dad. It's his handwriting.
Wow.
And it's the first time that she's gotten word that he's alive.
8 months.
Since, yeah.
And so she hadn't seen him in almost 3 years.
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
That's right. So then the letter was short and sweet.
Yeah.
It was my dad's style. I'm alive. I want you and Lewin to meet me at these coordinates. This is what you pack. These are the people that know. That's it.
That's it.
Here's the date and time.
Date and time to be there.
Yep.
Wow.
And she was like, I'm in.
Nice trust.
I mean, I'm in. And just to hear, so that was sort of my mom's side of it, right?
Yeah.
And then she was just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then Dad starts telling me about how during those 8 months, he knew not to go home.
Yeah.
He knew that home would be where they were looking for him. So he went to a town called Vung Tau. It's like on the east, he's on the coast of Vietnam. And it was about a 2 hours drive.
Oh, wow.
From where he was, from where our hometown was,
mm-hmm.
right? So he knew not to go home. He had shaved his beard and cut his hair and was really working under the dark of the night and cover of the
right.
night and just contacting people that he trusted and just saying, hey, I've got a plan.
Yeah.
I want to just escape this place.
Yeah.
I want to flee. I want to go somewhere else. This is not what I fought for. And obviously my own countrymen, I'm against this. Let's get out of here.
Did you want to go to America?
So there are a lot of people like us in,
yeah.
in history, known as the boat people, who have refugees from Vietnam. And, you know, let me get to that in 1 second.
Yeah, sure.
And during this time, he just knew we want to get out of there.
Right.
But whenever you flee, you're at risk of so many other things.
Yeah.
First, he had to find out, who's a guy that can help me pull this off?
Yeah.
And then that led to him meeting another guy, which all crazy story ended up being a former North Vietnamese guy, you know, so it was just like very like trust issues, what's going on here. He said it was his sixth plan that worked through. Plan one through five fell through for whatever reason. The hardest part was finding a boat. Because if you had a boat, you were a fisherman or you were someone looking to plan and escape. He had to get a boat built, and he started to contact people who, family that wanted to know and people who could escape. And do you want to escape? Because there's risk of the sea. There's a big risk of the sea. And so all is happening. We ended up what was supposed to be a much smaller number. I want to say high 30s, low 40s became 67 people on this boat. And that is 24 foot long, 8 foot wide. It's a wooden boat. It's got an outboard motor.
Wow.
And, you know, Vietnamese people aren't large people, but
still
you
a lot come
in and it's a lot of bodies and you're packed in and it's every person gets one bag. It's water, it's gasoline, and it's rice. And let's see what the sea brings us and try to escape. So we ended up, he had staked out this area where he knew that he wanted us to hide out the night before. So there was this, Vung Tau is this beautiful mountainous region. And imagine this mountainous region, and then there's a two-lane road, and you go down a little bit more, and then there's the beach. Right, in the ocean.
So like, almost like the Pacific Coast Highway.
You got it. You got it, yeah.
Okay.
Not quite as rocky, but yeah, for sure. Okay. More trees and whatnot. Yeah. So in this land right here, he had found a cave, a little cave, where the 67 of us would stay there the night before.
Okay. How did your mom know how to get to this cave? You said coordinates.
Coordinates.
So she just, she knew coordinates and knew how to get to this. I mean, this is the middle of freaking mountain.
She, I mean, she had to find someone to like, hey, decipher this for me. The letter also said, who knew? And so that was like, hey, I know where it is.
Right.
You know, this is, so follow me. We meet here at this place. We run at the dark of night. We get into the cave. We stay there the entire day. We do not peep out. You know, you got to stay in there.
Right.
And so we're in the cave, and at 7 p.m., precisely 7 p.m., we're told to, we're going to run down the mountainside, cross the two-lane road.
That was a busy road.
That was a busy road. Cross the two-lane road where Dad had spoken to two North Vietnamese army men to do him a favor, because money talks, to do a random traffic stop at either end. And this random traffic stop, I need it for 30 minutes.
Right.
And that'll give the time for us to run down so that the cars and the mopeds would not see and say, hey,
there's people. There's
what's going on? People. And go and report you, right?
Right.
So we had a hope that that was going to fall through and happen. And I was like, Dad, how did you know these guys wouldn't just say, yeah, we'll do it for
take
you,
the
take your money and bop you upside the head and go bring you back? And he goes, I didn't. I just had to trust
somebody that had held him in captivity for 5 years.
Yeah. You I mean, talk about just bravery, right?
Yeah.
It was just like and the gumption to even think about doing that.
Yeah.
And say, hey, no questions asked, but this is what I need you to do. And they probably, they knew.
Absolutely.
And they're like, you know what? Good luck to you, bro.
Yeah.
You know?
Take your $50 and go away.
Yeah. And he said, money talks.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. And then I said, then what? He said, Dad had been calculating about it and looking at the calmest time of the seas of the year. And so that's why he wanted to go in April. He was watching the sunset. He was watching the guards who worked here. He was watching that. Oh, yeah, by the way, if we make it down past the road and we get to the beach, there's a tower here. And on this tower stands two guards watching for people to leave, just like us.
Right.
And he also saw that those two guards at 7 p.m., there was a shift change. Those two guards would leave their tower, go down to the bottom of the tower where there was a small house, and the two new guards who would do the night shift would come, and the four of them would eat dinner. And dinner would be 20 to 30 minutes, sometimes a little longer, and they would come out, have a couple smokes, and then the guards would change shifts. The two new guards would go up, and Dad saw that, you know, they felt that no one would really plan escape during that time because it wasn't quite dark yet.
Right. So and he knew that. So he had staked this thing out long enough to where he knew that there was a gap between 7 and 7:30.
That's right. And he says probably to this was just his guess. He said, but you know, most people they leave undercover at night, so it's 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. So these guards are probably going, no one's gonna
broad daylight
right now. Let's just have dinner together.
Yeah.
You know, and they would eat dinner together, have some coffee, some beers, and some cigarettes, and then they'd shift change at the top.
Right.
So there was this 30-minute window of getting through, past the road, past the guards, and hopefully when we run out there, Dad's supposed to be waiting for us with the boat.
With the boat.
Tied to a reef. So I'm just hearing this. I'm like going, oh, man, there's so many things that could go wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said, it was a sixth plan.
Yeah, that's right. That was the sixth plan. So, Mom then tells her side of it. Dad says, I got the boat. I'm waiting on the reef. And I'm just looking up into the mountains and going, are they coming? Are they going to come? Are they going to come? Are the guards going to see me? Is someone going to see me? And he sees it's just these people running down. And she said that she was carrying the backpack of our belongings. Mm-hmm. She gave me to someone else. She said... A strong young man to carry Lewin, and then because there were so many people in the boat, you couldn't bring it up to shore because you couldn't push it out.
So
you had to be in there, and you had to swim out, and you're just trying to run
right
to get out of there because you have to hop on the boat and get out of eyesight
before they get back
before
up
they get
the
back
tower.
Up and look and go, what is that? Right before they put up a binoculars and say, what is that? So you got a tight window, you want to run, but you don't want to make big splashing noise, and in the middle of it, these arms, I mean, you know how like just you running in waist-high water is making splashing everywhere.
Right, for sure.
Imagine 67 other people doing that, right? And in the middle of it, the kid drops me. And so now it's like, hold on.
Where's the baby?
Yeah, where's the baby? And there's lots of babies, right? But it's like, where's the baby?
Wow.
Yeah, they pull me out of it. We all get in there, start climbing, bringing people into the boat. And then we start going, boom, that outboard motor hits a reef and it bends the rudder. And then Dad just says, I remember having to hop out of the boat and me and a few men trying to bend this rod straight so we're not going in circles. We didn't have any tools.
Yeah, no.
Right? You get it going and you start motoring off, but you can't turn the engine on fast because, you know, so you're just starting to motor off real slow and just... did not know if they were going to come up and see us or not. So we then Dad goes into the story of how every day at sea was a new challenge.
How many days were y'all at sea?
Four.
4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So 67 people, 24-foot boat.
Yeah.
4 days at sea.
Yeah. Wow. And our goal was the Malaysian Islands.
Okay.
That was our goal. He says how there was one area of the very first thing that he had to navigate through, and he was just using the stars and what he had learned in the Army to navigate. And there was this one island that they were trying to avoid. They didn't have the gas or the time to go around the island this way, and they had to go this way for some reason, but you couldn't get too close to the island. And I was like, what's up with the island? He said, oh, it's a prison. So so there's guards there looking the whole time. So you getting to get too close, but you navigate around that. And the second day, there was a boat off in the distance, and they did not know whether to signal it or not.
Yeah.
And so you'd ask earlier, was the U.S. where you wanted to land? Absolutely.
For sure.
So the other, I have relatives who escaped, and they were picked up by other countries who were part of the NATO agreement that said, if you pick them up, you take them in as refugees and let them become citizens of
country. Your country.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have uncle and cousins who were picked up by German boats. They now live in Germany. I have uncle and relatives, British boats.
They're in England.
Yeah, that's right. They're in England. Spanish boats, right? Yeah. So of all the good guys, right, anyone will do, but man, U.S. would be number one.
Right.
Now you had other boats out there that were the bad guys, like the guys who would say, I'm going to bring you right back.
Taking you back.
So it could have been North Koreans. It could have been Chinese boats, Russian boats, North Vietnamese boats. Could have been fishermen who would just say, you know what, I'm going to turn you in.
Yeah.
Because I don't agree with what you were doing. Could have been people who just saw you and ignore you because they didn't want to get in trouble for
right.
helping you. It could be someone who did want to help you. But what they were most afraid of were the pirates. people who knew that you were escaping and knew that you were only bringing your valuables, and they wanted your valuables and your women. And so women like my mom would pack poison onto the trip with them. And if that happens, if it goes down that way, they were prepared to take their own life.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah, right? And so this boat, the second day, they did not, Dad said he didn't signal it. He said it followed him. It never got closer, it never got farther, but he never knew what it was. Third day, water supply had just sprung a leak. Rations were down to a capful.
So capful.
Capful, per person, you get a capful. I was super sick, mom had a bottle like this, hidden in her bag, and she would get the people around her to hold up a towel. And her excuse was, I'm going to change clothes. But underneath it, she was feeding me. Yeah. She was afraid that if she showed this bottle of water, everyone would take it. but yeah, we were down on gasoline because we were so many people, and then our water supply was low. Woke up the third day, and Dad said, I saw where we wanted to go. I saw the Malaysian islands. I saw people on the beach swimming in the water. I saw fishermen. I just saw a new life.
Right.
And it ended up being a mirage. And he was also crazy was everyone in the boat saw it. Everyone was hallucinating. They were so dehydrated. One person saw it, and the rest like, yeah, I see it. And you hear stories of people in the desert about them seeing water.
Sure.
It was the exact opposite.
Same thing.
And so Dad tells us that how that moment, when they realized it wasn't a real thing, and they kept on going that way, and it never would come up, and it would come sometimes disappear, it was such a morale killer.
Right.
That on the fourth day, when there was another boat off in the distance, there was a big debate. What are we going to do? We're out of this. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
And he felt, you know, it was his show. It was his... Right. His doing, and he felt that he was responsible for all these lives. And he said, you know, it was one of those decisions where I had to just decide.
Yeah.
And he knew his fate if it was the wrong decision. He said, you know, your mom and you probably would have been fine, but I knew what they were going to do with me. So he just took out the flare and shot it.
Oh, wow. Okay, so he did have something to...
Yeah.
Okay.
Took out the flare gun, shot it, and he just waited. And just wait.
Yeah.
And he says the strangest thing. One boat in the distance became two. Just like that. And he was like, what's going on? Man, it ended up being, the second boat ended up being a small tugboat that was pulling us in. And when they tied us up, they pulled us in, and they realized who it was.
Right.
And I'm like, it's the U.S. Navy. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And Dad said, Lou, and I'll never forget it. You spend all this time fighting for your country and fighting alongside this country that you want to belong to. You spend 5 years plus in prison. You escape. You plan this escape. And you're at sea thinking you're at the, you know, you're at the end of your life and on your rope. And he said the moment that they pulled us up and we looked up, it was an LS destroyer ship, the USS Thomaston, big cannons.
Yeah.
And he said, all of a sudden, the clouds separated, the sunshine through, the American flag was waving, and he said all 300-plus soldiers were at deck at salute.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Crazy.
And they brought him in, and, you know, they found out he was a captain, so everywhere he went, they were saluting him, captain. And, of course, they fed us right away, gave us clothes. And they were out there looking for people like us, refugees. And the captain of that boat, of the big ship, he was talking to my dad, and he said, when we pulled your boat in, your little boat in, our little wooden one, it sank.
Unbelievable.
It sank, like, before the big ship could kind of pull up anchor and, and get going again, our little boat sank. And he said, you were about... another 5 days for the Malaysian Islands.
Five more days?
Yeah. He's going at your pace.
So like, y'all were just floating. Yeah. Because it sounded like you had said originally it was like 30, 35 people, and it in essence doubled. So in essence, you didn't have enough gas to get to wherever you were going.
Right.
And so
we're just floating.
We're just really just floating at sea.
Yeah, man.
5 more days.
Yeah.
So what happened? I mean, get you guys on the boat. What happened then?
So we are taken to a refugee camp. And our refugee camp was in Singapore.
Okay.
So we land in Singapore, and we ended up residing there for about 3-4 months. Just to get all of our immunization shots, all of our paperwork,
gotcha,
all that stuff. So, you know, Dad was just a natural leader, and he ended up helping, being a big help in that refugee camp, being a translator for a lot of the people. And then it was, okay, you and your family get 3 plane tickets to anywhere USA. Where do you guys want to go? Oh, you also get a stipend, $1,500 a person, right? So now we have $4,500 to our pocket to start naming the U.S. Mom takes $3,000 and sends it back home.
Does she really?
Yeah. She was like, Lillian, $3,000 is like $20,000 back home. It is so powerful.
Why are, and we'll get to that later, but like that's crazy that's a common theme in Hispanic workers. I've got some Guatemalan worker. I mean,
yeah,
that's so common. Why did she do that?
She said they needed it more than we do.
Yeah.
I remember asking her.
Yeah.
I was like, Mom, what are you doing? Like, we need the money. Like, right, we don't know what this. She's like, oh no, they need it way more than we do. We're going to be fine. And I said, so where do we go? I mean, I knew where, but I was like, how did you decide?
Yeah.
Where we were going to go. So we landed in U.S. soil, right, at L.A. Airport. We had $15 by the time we landed.
Wow.
We then started life in Fort Walton Beach, Florida.
How'd you get from L.A. to...
Right.
Yeah.
And Dad said, I knew of one other gentleman who had fled and escaped prior to us, and he and his wife, and I think they had one child, they were living in a 2-bedroom apartment in Fort Walton Beach, Florida.
Wow.
And he said, if you make it to the States, you need a place to stay.
Come stay
with us. It was like this family of 6, right, in a 2-bedroom apartment. And Dad started immediately. Mom started to babysit and picked up seamstress work. Dad started to study up English more and enrolled himself in technical school. And then he got a job as a technician, working on typewriters, copy machines, photo machines, photocopy machines, Xerox.
Yeah.
And then old school typewriters.
Yeah,
he would work on that. I mean, he would have to go to class at a JUCO. I forgot which JUCO he went to get his degree.
And y'all were in Fort Walton still?
Fort Walton still. And would write down everything and go home and read, translate it to Vietnamese, study in Vietnamese, give his answers and translate them back.
Right. Had to, yeah.
Yeah, had to. And then eventually, you know, there's another cool, crazy story about how he got to Mobile. He was there for a job interview and eventually moved our family to Mobile. And that's kind of where we started.
That's incredible. So, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you had as much fun as I did in this interview. We would love to hear your input and who you would like for us to interview on the Entrepreneur Dad podcast. Also, we would love it if you would give us a review and a rating. What that does for us is it helps us so much in our business and so much with the Entrepreneur Dad podcast. If you have any suggestions or would just like to ask a question in general, please email us, thomas@theentrepreneurdad.com. That's thomas@theentrepreneurdad.com. Thank you so much. We look forward to serving you.